Mr. Jewett, Reel 2. You started as an office boy in London. What kind of work, what was your particular responsibilities?
Right, well, first of all, going for the job, I remember getting off at Blackfriars Station and walking up Victoria Street past Unilever House, because I went to the wrong place, and I went to 307 Winchester House, it was then. It's not there now, but it was on the fourth floor of Winchester House. And I was very impressed. I'd never been in London, the city of London. I was sort of, it was a strange world to me, but I went on my own up there. And I went in front of Mr. Kellum, who was one of the senior partners, told me what the wages were and everything, what I had to do. And obviously, you know, I was very honoured to get the job, because, and now the strange thing was, it was not a dead-end job. It was because when it was W.A. Brown's was a firm that had a great, funnily enough, Colonel Brown was the founder of the firm, had a great tradition that when you joined Brown's, you stayed with Brown's. All their audit staff and all their staff were people that had gone there, had been articled with them and everything. And had I stayed at Brown's, I would have become a chartered accountant, because they articled, they lent their kids the money, because it was 250 quid. Could you imagine finding 250 quid to be articled in those days in 1936 37? Let me see, it'd be about 37, I was 14. I've got to work it out, actually. But that was when having said that, what my job was, the next step up was a junior clerk, which I became later on, but the first job you got was indexing all the letters. You had a very weird and wonderful thing where when they sent the letters out, they had them in letter books. It was like tissue paper and a damp cloth, and you put them in a letter press, and you pressed the thing down, and the imprint of the letter came out onto the book, you see, and it was but the trouble was, the letter was all crinkled up with being wet, you see. You had to be very careful not to make it too wet, otherwise it ran, you see. The letter itself ran, and there's usually about a dozen letters a day, or maybe more, and all of them had to be indexed under in the index of this letter book, this great big letter book, and you had a great big press, you know, and this, you had to press it down and leave it there for a few minutes. I had it off to it, and you answer the telephone, and they had one of these little telephones, and our telephone was London Wall 3811, I think it was, something like that, and I know it was London Wall something, and run messages and all that kind of thing. Or make the tea. I used to make the coffee and the tea, and every birthday, it was my job to cut the cake up, so that everybody who was not in auditing, because they had all the auditors, you know, there's about 20 or 30 in each auditor, they were all out in companies, all auditing books, you see, but everybody who was sort of at base used to get a cake, you know, for a birthday cake, and I always used to cut the cake so that you'd hardly notice it, but the one that was left last for me was the biggest one. Everybody else, I used to cut it in such a clever way that clever things are, as if they didn't know. When I look back, I bet they had some laughs at my expense. He used to cut his slack. I can remember I was a 14-year-old lad, you know. And the cake they always had was Fuller's walnut cake. I always used to have to go across and buy these, and they had walnut. They were fantastic cakes, I kid you not. They were great. Don't know if you can buy them now. But obviously the largest slice used to go to Fred, and they used to cut it up between them. they were happy days.
What was your first wage?
My first wage? My first wage was 18 shillings a week. But I had to find my bus fare. My train fare out of that, you know. My fare. And I used to get a workman's ticket from Welling to Cannon Street. I think it cost 10p return, and you had to catch the last workman's train was the 8 o'clock. No, tell a lie. 7:30, and you had to be in London by 8 o'clock. I think that was the way it went. I'm going, it's a bit of a tricky thing trying to remember that. And it was 10p, I think it was. and that was the return. But that was sort of things you had to buy, and you had to buy obviously your lunch, your sandwiches or whatever. Your mum used to put some sandwiches up for me, you know, and I used to spend, I had an hour off for lunch, and they were a great firm to work for. They were absolute gentlemen, they really were. There were four partners, they were all chartered accountants, and they were all sort of men of great substance, and they were the real, I suppose, the old-fashioned Tories, the old-fashioned Conservative, the real true blue, if you know what I mean. And but they were gentlemen to work for. I used to have to lay out the boardroom when they had board meetings, which was quite frequently. I used to have clean blotting paper already, you know, and pencils and everything already for the board committee, for the members of the board to come in, and they'd come in, and they were all so nice, but they were all great with me, because I suppose I was a bit of a scallywag, you know, what lads, what kids are, you know, and you're much the favourite. But then what happened?
Did you hand your money over to your mother?
That's right. Mum got the money, of course, you know. But I got my pocket money, you know. But if you remember, I worked in the morning. I used to have that was mine. That 6 bob was mine, and that bought all sorts of things like cricket stumps and cricket. Oh, I was a very popular lad. I had a set of cricket
stumps.
What
time did your working day start?
9 o'clock until 5 o'clock.
And you had to leave home at what time to get to work?
Oh, something about 7:30. Let me see. Walk up to the... Yeah, I had to catch the 25 past 7 train at Welling. So I would leave home about 7 o'clock. But I delivered a set of papers before then. But I had a bike, you know, because that was very, very...
What time did you finish your work?
Oh, I got home. I finished work at 5 o'clock. Then I'd go from there. I'd take all the mail to the and post the mail. And sometimes record it, sometimes register it, you know, sometimes, especially to India, because they were, the Bar Sea Light Railway Company was, they were secretaries for a number of other companies, if you know what I mean. I would get home, I'd probably get the 25 past 5 at Cannon Street, and then go, which was packed, packed like sardines, I kid you, legs hanging out the windows, I get home probably about 6 weeks or something like that.
And yeah. Did that include working on a Saturday?
Oh, no, there
just
was
a 5-day week.
Just a 5-day week, yeah, there was no Saturdays at all. No, you didn't work, well, of course, in those days, funny thing, it was a lovely firm to work for. They used to have play the Ronick, they were secretaries for Ronick, you know, the Ronick polishing people, they moved to Port Slade, I think Portis or Brighton anyway, and every year they used to have a cricket match. It was great fun, and it was a treat on the farm. They took everybody down, you dined at the Ship Hotel, and then you played cricket. So it so happens I had some whites, because I played cricket for the school. I didn't tell you that, but anyway, I played cricket for the school and football for the school, you see. But my love at the school was boxing, as I'll tell you later on. But anyway, I was the office boy, saying all the audit staff, and they were all sort of public school and God knows what, you know, all larty tickle to me anyway. And they put me down. They said, "Can you play?" I said, "Well, I'll play cricket, yeah. What you do? Oh, I won't do anything, you know, bowl, bat, you know." So they put me down to bat, you see. And I was about, sort of, I think, 7th or 8th wicket down, you see. So... anyway, I went in and I belted that they couldn't bowl for toffee, these old boys, you know, in Ronick team, and I got the highest score. I was a hero in the firm. Young Joe, he did well recently. Yeah, so I carried my bat out. So I'll never forget that. Were great days. But you've got to remember, this is very, very ultra amateurish. This lot, you know.
Annual leave did you get?
I can't remember. I think it was a fortnight. We all got the same. It was very, very good. I think it was a fortnight. Might have been 3 weeks, but I think it was a fortnight going back. All the family went away in the summer, like sort of thing, and we went away just.
And then you said that you got promoted to.
Oh yeah, the junior clerk. Yeah, that's right. And it didn't make a lot of difference. I looked after the petty cash then, you see. That was a real lift up. You know, I had the cash book to look after. You know, anybody wanted if anybody wanted to go across London and want some money, well, yeah, that was signed there. And I was really big stuff. This was, but the firm, I wouldn't have stayed there. They would have given my father the chance to article me. As an article clerk to that company. But anyway, I tell you what, one day they made a mistake. They had an urgent letter for me to deliver, and I can remember it. It was Sir John Glenmillan Partners, and they lived somewhere in Buckingham Gate, something in London, in the West End of London. And on the way, I had to go past Whitehall. And when I went past Whitehall, I stopped at the naval went past the naval recruiting office, where outside they had all these photographs, you see, of all these places abroad. Boy, this is for me, sort of thing. These wonderful photographs of the China station and the West Indies station and all the whites, you know, and all this ship. Oh, God, love me, that's great. So I looked at this, and I said to the man, I would realise he's a chief petty officer now, but I didn't know then, can I have some particulars of, you know, joining the Navy? And how old are you, son? I'm 15, so I got the particulars, and I took the particulars, and I took them home, delivered me letter, and went home. And I played around with this. To cut a long story short, I applied to join the Navy. And, of course, the truth was, it was a bomb. When I told the chief clerk at Brown's, a fellow called Pendred, lovely man actually. Funnily enough, he was in the REMCs and all as well, like my dad. And I think that's possibly why he liked me a lot. But I told him. He says, and they couldn't believe it. I was the first one to. This was the first somebody left the firm. Oh no, you know, you just didn't leave Brown's. You know, you stayed. You joined us. And you stayed there till you were 65, sort of thing, you know. I mean, old Potter, God knows how old he was. He must have been about 70, I should think. And they used to have these high chairs, you know. And have you seen these high desk chairs? Well, the desks were very high. And the writing, I learned to write copper plate writing there, you know. Script, you know, scrawly writing. They taught you that. That's the sort of thing. I mean, I can't remember all the things you learnt there, but... It was a fantastic firm to work for. I mean, you talk about the cruelty of the... Don't you believe it? These people were gentlemen and they treated you... You got treated with the respect. And I remember when I got Berys, Mr. Pelham, rather, called me in because he looked after the wages for the staff, you know, the staff. Called into the office, very dignified. Yes, he said, we've got... In appreciation of your services, we've got an appreciate. We're giving you a rise, and I can remember him asking, giving me the rise. You know, about 4 shillings a week or something like that. Brought it up to about 22. There was something nice about those days, you know, gentlemanly.
Was it a sense of adventure that caused you to join the Navy? I didn't have a background of Navy.
No, I tell you what it was. It was because of Potter. Poor old Potter, he used to sit on his own at the back there, on his high desk, and writing away. And he had about five estates to look after, and sort of, they have various people, like you said. For example, if you had employed a chartered accountant, somebody would look after your affairs, you see, and he had five or six. And I thought to myself, you know, I turned it over, and in my little mind says, God, I don't think I can stand this for the rest of my life, you know, because it was... The City of London is a dark, dreary, very interesting, because I used to tour it when I was in my lunch hour. I thought, I can't stand this for the rest of my life. And I applied, and I had to wait 6 months before I got a reply, and I had to get a referee, and I asked the housekeeper of Winchester House, who had been a retired lieutenant. I knew he'd been in the Navy, and I said, can you give me a reference? And he gave me a marvellous reference to join the Navy. That's the way it was then. You just didn't join up, you know. And all these kids, when I went out, I had to go to...
You say you filled a form in, you applied...
Yeah, I had to get to my parents' permission and everything.
I was gonna say, how did your parents take
it? Oh, they I don't think they were that keen, Mike, but they wouldn't stand in their way, sort of thing, you know. They wouldn't stand in their way. They they weren't that keen, but they sort of said, oh, well, because I was the eldest son, you know, and...
You applied through what? Filling a form in? Or
filling the form and sending it away.
And this lieutenant that you got the reference from, did he know you? Or?
Oh, yes, he knew me every day. I used to... You see, I was the first in to Winchester House, and I used to have to draw the keys from... His name was Hindmarsh, that's right. His name from Mr. Hindmarsh, who was the housekeeper. He had a place on the top of the building. He was the housekeeper. Now that's a hell of a job. He had all the staff of, I mean, you think of a housekeeper. He had all the staff of Winchester House, which were all in uniform. You know, all the lift people and everything. He was a big crush.
Winchester House. Was this the place you went to when they accepted you?
Oh, no. No, this is where I worked. My place of employment. Well, Mr. Hindmarsh, of course, he gave me this. I had to have two references. I got one from the school, one from Mr. Hindmarsh. But then, eventually, with the passage of time, I got another letter asking me to report to the recruiting office in Whitehall. When I went there, there was about 40 other lads. But now we're coming on to a new phase of my life. We're moving now into my service career. You know, I'd left Brownsby, I'd burnt my boats there, sort of thing, and that was it. I'd left the city behind me and everything. But
do you remember the date on which you actually joined?
Yes, I can. Okay, I've got it on my service certificate. It was 1939, and it was July, and I think it was the 7th of July. 1939. It's on my service. I could have to dig it out for you.
It's a good point at this point in time, before you actually go into service. Did you know, were you aware that there were troubles coming in the late 30s? Indications?
There was rumblings, but there were always rumblings. Nobody, I mean, I joined the service for a career. You see, my conditions of service were, I did... my boy's time till I was 18, and then I did 12 years, what they call continuous service. I was a 12-year man, which was a real pucker sailor. And that meant, of course, that I went to HMS Ganges as a boy to do the pucker boys' training. It must have cost the country quite a lot of money, I should imagine, in hindsight, to train each boy, you know. And they are nursed along. I mean...
But you had no conception that war was coming, not at all. And were there any preparations that were being made at this time?
Oh, yes, there were. 39? Yes, there were. They were starting to you've jogged my memory. They were starting to issue gas masks just before the war, and I remember going to Hook Lane School, where they were issuing gas masks to volunteer, which I volunteered while I was waiting to be called up. Wait. And I volunteered helping people fit gas masks. You know, fitting gas masks, these civilian gas masks on. And I remember that was at that time, actually. Yes, that was just before then. That was coming up. So people were aware that there could be sort of trouble, you know, there was a trouble, but there was no panic or anything. I know exactly where I was when war broke out.
I was going to ask you that question, but before that, your father had been through a pretty horrendous war.
He
must have known that things were getting black again.
Yeah, probably.
Did
so.
He show it? Did he talk about
no,
it?
No, not at all. No, not at all. Not at all. No, no. No, there was no, I suppose there was no... no panic, no worries, no. People were starting to. I think they were starting to put blackouts up and think buy blackout materials and put sticky stuff over the windows and things like all that kind of thing. Oh, and the other thing they were doing, they were delivering shelters. You know, these Anderson shelters. You know, and you had to dig. You had to start digging shelters and things like that. That was all going on.
Was there any evidence of anti-German feeling prior to the war itself, prior to the outbreak?
Yes, I think it was. Yes, I've got to say this. It was pretty well known that Germany had become very strong and was very flexing its muscles. But by the same coin, I can only speak as a laddie. I thought, you know, I'm English, I'm British, we can take the world on, you know, let them all come, sort of thing. That's the sort of attitude that, I know it was a bit stupid, I know, but that's the attitude that we had in those days, you know, it didn't matter who the hell, let them bring them on, we'll take them on, we've got the biggest navy in the world, and, you know, and the RAF, that's the way it was. There wasn't any fear or anything like that. It was a question of, well, if I want to get cocky, well, we're the boys. Because none of us realised, I don't think any of us realised the might of the German army and what they'd done. One of the auditors at Brown's daughter used to go to Germany, and she used to come back and tell, and I remember him telling us in the office about this, and nobody took any bloody notice, you know. Nobody took a blind bit of notice. But I can remember him saying this, like she'd been on holiday in Germany and come back, seen all these tanks and arms and armaments and the build-up for what, I don't know. You know. And I can remember that. Now that you mention it, it's jogged my memory.
But you actually joined the Navy prior to the outbreak of war.
Yes, I did, yes. Yeah, that was in September.
So we've got you to the first place you went to, the 40 lads that were
waiting.
That's
right, yeah.
What was the process of getting you in?
We went in, I can tell you now, we went into the recruiting office at Whitehall, which was a big place. I mean, it's a big, walloping great big place. Well, right, the front of, it was in Whitehall, and we went into this place, which was rather a dark building, went in, and of course we lined up. And from there on, it started. They took an examination. They did a written examination. We had to take this written examination, and which of course we handed in the papers. And those who passed, and those who didn't were taken to one side. Good morning, thank you very much, and they paid your fare, I suppose, and back they went. But I was one of the ones who passed. So then from there on, you get the medical examination, and the doctor goes over you. You have to bend your toes, do this, do that, do the other, and particularly your eyesight. They were extremely, I had 6.6 plus eyesight, I was very fortunate. They were very, very keen on that, I remember. And hearing, eyesight, everything. And then when you finished, would be, because you reported there about 9:30 in the morning, and you were finished about 5 o'clock at night, so it took you pretty well all day, the joining procedure at that time in the Navy for a boy. After that, we were all ready, and those who were left, because some of them got weeded out on the way, we were on our way to Shotley, and we were taken up in civilian clothes. We just had civilian clothes, nothing at all, you know. Took her on our way to Shotley, and
did you have to take any oath at this point of yours as a young boy?
No, I don't think. I can't recall taking any oath at all, to tell you the truth. I think
did they ask you what branch of the Navy you're interested in?
Yes, they did. Then they said it was not much good asking us at that, because we didn't. None of us really knew much about it. That came later, actually, when we'd been in for about 6 weeks. So from there, we went up to Shotley, and I noticed that the petty officer who was being so nice to us, suddenly he wasn't nasty, but he was a bit firmer. Shall we put it that way? He kind of let us know that he was in charge, and he was too. Right. So we arrived in. I was in the annex of HMS Ganges, where you have the expression, you were called nozzers. And in the distance, I could see the main barracks in the distance, because it's a great big, walloping great big mast, which is very famous, actually. The Ganges mast is very famous. And we joined. Now, you can talk about discipline, if you like, till you're blue in the face. There is no discipline to compare with that which a boy seaman undergoes in his training at HMS Ganges. I should imagine that the Bill of Human Rights and the European Committee would have come down on our government like a ton of bricks. There was no way that they would have stood for any, even half, that went on at barracks. Now, I mentioned before that I represented the school in boxing. And do you know, that was the one good thing that happened in my life when I joined the Navy. Because when we went down, later on, to the gym, they put us through our paces, and I was a pretty fit lad, but I was a damn good boxer. For an amateur, you know, for an amateur kid, I was a good boxer. And I belted one. They made us go in what they call milling teams. And milling teams, one after the other, you just take your chance as to who you got. You know, and I came up against a great big bloke, and twice my size, and absolutely half killed the poor lad, you know, because he hadn't a clue. And I was sort of... Oh, it was duly taken notice of by the rest of the boys. This is one you do not mess about with. That was as simple as that. And yet I was never a bully. I was never ever push my weight about. But I was quite a good hand with me, as the mitts, as the saying goes.
But the Navy had a tradition of boxing, hadn't it?
Oh, not half. Yes, right. Yes, it was that they really did. I can tell you some funny stories.
Come back now to the moment you walk through the doors, gates of this...
HMS Ganges, or the Annex.
Can you describe the buildings and area?
Yes, it wasn't Nissen Huts. It was very similar, though. It was a collection of large... Oh, Romney Huts, they call them. Great big Romney Huts, you know. And the messes were in those. There was about 20 boys to a mess, and they were permanent because they had polished the floor. The floor was wood, you know, you had to polish it. And when that was finished, you were issued then with your kit. Now, in those days, you had it had to be laid out in service fashion, but all of your pants, vests, like your vests and all the rest of it, you went down to the store, and they gave you a block with your name, F.T. Jewett in my case, stamped on it, and that had to be sewn in, that with needle and cotton. That was the first thing you did when you went to join the Navy. You sewed your name in all your suits, your trousers, your collars, all the articles of kit that could be sewn, put a needle in, was sewn in. I used to think, how lucky these lads who were called Cox. They were lucky, but if your name was Blenkinsop or something like that, you had a rough time because you had a lot of sewing to do.